Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. That sound is distinctly American. The earliest forms of the banjo came to this country with the West African slaves during the Middle Passage, and since then, the instrument has become a centerpiece in Southern musical traditions.
Chicago-born musician, researcher, and author Stephen Wade has been fascinated with the banjo since he was a child. He's turned that passion into a lifelong quest to uncover and document American folk songs and playing styles. He's played at the White House, on Broadway, and now he's here in Milwaukee for 2 months with the beautiful music all around us. It's a one-man show based on his book of the same name. He joins us in the studio now playing an unnamed tune on a small birchwood banjo. Stephen Wade, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Bonnie.
Tell me about this wonderful instrument that we just heard. It is fretless. It is a banjo, but it is not what most people would recognize.
Well, except if you lived in Western North Carolina. This thing, it's a wooden-bodied banjo with a little possum skin head, and this is made by a man who lived Western North Carolina by the name of Clifford Glenn, and this is a traditional design. This is the last banjo he ever made. It's kind of like an axe handle. It's that simple in terms of its look. But these wood-rimmed banjos were a popular thing, and they don't cut like no store-bought banjo, as he said, with the metal parts that we're more used to seeing. But, you know, I mean, banjos have had all kinds of designs just as much as they've had all kinds of players. And the earliest banjos in the 18th century, there were banjos in America brought here via slavery. And they were made out of gourds.
So the gourds were the first.
Yeah, that kind of design. So you'd cut the top of like a pumpkin off and stretch a head, tack it on, and have a neck coming off the side. And there weren't metal strings then. That changes over time. And the banjos become more like a machine later on, latter part of the 19th century.
How did you get interested in them, and how did it become your instrument? I mean, you grew up in the rock and roll era. You could have easily become an electric guitarist.
Electric guitar when I was 10, and my guitar teacher was a Chicago blues player you've probably heard of. He lives here in Wisconsin, Jim Schwall, Siegel Schwall Blues Band. I've been playing banjo for a long time now. I just loved it. I wanted to play banjo back even before I had an electric guitar. It was just hard in my family to figure out one banjo from another, really. I'm looking over Four-Leaf Clover and songs like that were popular on the radio. But I knew, I'd heard Earl Scruggs on the radio too, and I knew that it wasn't the same. But it was hard for us at home to actually realize or recognize there were more than two kinds of banjos. And the one I wanted was the one with the fifth string. With that drone thing going. Or, you know, Earl would sound more, let me put this other one, would sound more like this. And that's what I was after already. You know, when I was 5 or 6, and I just wanted that so bad. But it took a while to get it all sorted out. And then I was very fortunate because my teacher taught Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago, Fleming Brown. He really took me in. And then I started playing with his teacher, Doc Hopkins, who'd been on National Barn Dance for 22 years. He did a live radio shows there, and so I had sort of a grandfather and a father in it, and then they urged me to travel around the country and learn more about the music from other players in their homes, which is what I did, and sort of built out from that and those experiences, which really led to my book and were the model for my book, really.
One of the things I love about the banjo, and we were talking again before we turned on the microphones, it's such an American sound. It's such an American look into our culture that we have exported to other parts of the world. I mean, it's interesting how people in Ireland have picked up the banjo, you know, and brought sort of the music back, some of those things, you know, how it's gone back and forth.
Well, that's true. I mean, in minstrelsy, what happened in UK was minstrelsy, which was an international craze, which gets going in the early 1840s, gets played here in America by Irish-American or Irish immigrant musicians corking up, blacking up. Then goes back to Ireland, and the banjo takes a place there many more years later to the service of Irish music. And that's, I think, what you're referring to. The idea of the banjo as a metaphor for America, I think, is true. Here's a music brought here by black players, black musicians, and shared with mountain whites to make a new music for us all. It's across the Americas. There is no banjo equivalent, really, in Europe. There are banjo-like instruments in India and in Japan, banjo-like in the sense of skin head, a bridge, the way the sound is made. But what comes here is through memory, in the sense of slaves bringing it across the Middle Passage, not maybe the physical object, but the idea of it. And then it changes here. This is not the same as music from West Africa, by no means, nor are the techniques necessarily the same. The recent research in early black banjo history is showing some of those techniques of being present in certain parts.
So there is some of the technique here that we use that is also used in West Africa?
Yes, by analogy, and by there are certain ways that it does seem to be very similar. And more research is looking into that and finding these kinds of parallels. It's interesting that here to be in Milwaukee, because the person who was the leading expert on early black banjo history was born in Milwaukee. I talk about her in the program notes to what I wrote here for Milwaukee Rap. Her name was Dina Epstein, and she was born here in 1913, and I played at her funeral service earlier last year in 2014. She became the music librarian at the University, a music librarian at the University of Chicago for 22 years. And in the course of all that, was writing about early spirituals and the first documentation of spirituals, and found herself slipping into writing about early banjo, and wrote this landmark book that came out in 1977 called Sinful Tunes and Spirituals. And in that, she was looking in 18th century documents, letters, diaries, newspapers, finding evidence of the banjo in America. And it was actually she who was responsible in certain ways for me to have my book, because my book is in the same series as hers. And she's one who told my late editor about me back in the early 80s. And then Judy McCullough from the University of Illinois Press came out to see me in Washington and suggested that I write something. And so I think about Dina here in your town and being coming from here.
Will you play something for us?
It just occurs to me to play maybe something of that sort of older sound that Dina was touching on in her research.
That's gorgeous. What was the name of that tune?
Well, Elzik's Farewell. And I think it's got kind of an old musicality to it, don't you?
Yeah, it's almost got that modal
sound. Oh, it is modal.
It's complete. It is? It's, okay.
That is in a modal tuning. That's right. You're right. It's a modal sound and it's a modal tune. And just in, and it allows itself for sort of lots of little textural variation, it seems to me. Has a little space in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And
plus, it was frailing like your mother did.
Yes, it was the frailing.
That was the important thing.
The important thing.
It was your mom in this.
It was, yeah. And we probably should talk a little bit about those. That's a picking style. Frailing is a kind of picking style.
It's a down picking style. I play in a bunch of styles just depending on the different tunes or the different songs or the different players. And that's what I try to do. So I don't try to filter everything through one kind of right-hand technique, but rather go the opposite way with that. And that kind of individuation or that kind of variety is, well, that's how it works with all these kinds of songs. And the book only has one banjo song in it. There's kids' songs, there's religious songs, there's quartet songs, there's ensemble music, secular, sacred, male, female, black, white, Native American. And there's just a variety there as there really is. But in all these cases, you have these, you know, created products for which many share their creative responsibility. I mean, that's what goes on in folk music. You have a tune and people handle it in all kinds of different ways. I mean, like a song like Old Joe Clark, I mean, you know that one. Your mom must have played that for you. I mean, so normally the melody goes, or ordinarily the melody goes. But I remember on one of these Library of Congress recordings, I love so much a 1939 recording of Wade Ward, who was a banjo player from Independence, Virginia. And he handled, you know, Old Joe Clark his own special way. There's a couple of techniques in there.
A couple of different techniques in there. And it sounds like it was almost the precursor to like the Scruggs style, the three-finger.
Well, it is like a precursor to it. And the second part where I started finger-picking like that was something that someone who was from sort of very near where Earl Scruggs grew up played like.
Do you worry that there isn't anyone coming behind you that will take up this mantle and continue the tradition of, we're never going to discover all the songs, we're never going to find them all, but people need to keep doing that. Are there people behind you who
are? Well, I don't feel that way at all. I mean, I have a couple doctoral students who are getting their dissertations right now that just wrote me last night. That exploration, of course, goes on, as does this creativity, just in new and other ways. I mean, the whole thing that was on the radio here about what the little girls have they're playing with the cups and making all those percussive sounds. I mean, that's the same old stuff with rhythm variations. And I mean, that's a very old music that's going on there in new ways. I don't find modernity a threat to informal music. It changes and things change inevitably, but it always was changing. It's not fixed. So I'm not worried. I mean, the people I learned from and the people I talked to some 200 people in the course of writing my book, and most of them have passed on, But those people are gone. But these ideas are not gone. I mean, this, again, this sort of informal music is going to go. I mean, the truth, just go to church. I mean, just what goes on all over America on Sundays, and these old forms that are there are being recreated. I mean, just, you know, where I live around Washington, D.C., that, you know, in my own neighborhood, there's, you know, I can walk by, there's a church a block from my house, and it's just 1950s rhythm and blues happening in there. It really is, except it's in the service of the Lord. And it's that sort of thing. That is going on. That's a reality. And so I'm not worried in that respect. No, and I don't feel like, you know, anything more than optimism.
That's good to hear, because I think the fear, at least for me, is that when people who are so passionate about it like you are no longer here, that passion dies with you. And so it sounds like the mantle is being handed down, and that people are still interested, and people younger are anxious to find out not only what the history of all of this is, but pushing it forward into new ways of exploring it and expressing it.
Terrific. Me nodding yes on the radio does a lot of good. All I can do is assent to what you're saying. Honestly, you said it very well just now, and I concur. I'm sorry, you said it all, kiddo. I can't add to that. You just nailed it.
Well, what you can do that I can't is you can play us another tune to wrap up. But I want to first thank you, Stephen, for stopping by and bringing the instruments. And
sure.
I'm so looking forward to seeing the show here at the Rep,
thanks.
As are a lot of us. And tell me what you're going to play us out with.
I'll play a new tune that sounds old, written by a traditional musician, a band who used to play with Bill Monroe. His name is Tony Ellis, and he wrote this tune. I produced it. We did this record and some years back.
Stephen Wade is an American folklorist, a Grammy-nominated musician, and the author of the book, The Beautiful Music All Around Us, Field Recordings, and the American Experience. John Strelecki engineered his performance in Lake Effect's Studio C1.
Wade opened his one-man show, also called The Beautiful Music All Around Us, at the Milwaukee Rep last week. It runs at the Stechner Cabaret through March 15th, and there's more information at WUWM.com. Lake Effect sports contributor waxes philosophical on the end to the Packers season when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.